He's about 455 yards away. He's going to hit about a 2-iron, I think.
This is the School of Motion podcast. Come for the MoGraph, stay for the puns.
So if we're just talking about a single person, your options really are then a sole proprietor, a C corporation, an S corporation, or a single person LLC.
Welcome to part two of the Andy Contagulia episode. Who is Andy Contagulia? Well, if you missed part one of this interview, you may want to go back and start there in the previous episode. Andy is a small business lawyer based out of Denver, Colorado. In the last episode, we talked about dealing with clients, contracts, and a bunch of other legal ideas. And in this episode, we're going to go deep into the topic of incorporating. If you're freelance, if you're thinking of starting a studio one day, you're probably going to need to think about forming a corporate entity, as they're called. And I know it's confusing. There's all these different kinds of corporations, S-Corp, C-Corp, LLC, it's different tax implications. And we try to do our best to demystify all of that in this episode. First, I have to say a whole lot of words so that we don't get sued. The legal information contained in this podcast is intended for general informational and entertainment purposes only. It should be used only as a starting point for addressing your specific legal issue. The legal information I talk about does not create an attorney-client relationship between you and me or you and Andy. This podcast is not a substitute for an in-person or telephone consultation with a lawyer who is licensed to practice in your jurisdiction about your specific legal issue, and you should not rely on this legal information for those purposes. You understand that questions and answers or other information contained in this podcast are not confidential and are not subject to attorney-client privilege. Neither I nor Andy are providing you a legal service. Every legal case is different, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Bottom line, please consult your own attorney. All right. Whew. Now, let's do this. Here comes part two. Andy, now I want to talk about another enormous topic that we get questions about all the time. And I know just enough to be dangerous, but I imagine you're going to know a lot more about this, which is, should I incorporate as a freelancer? Why don't we just start with like the big question? Why would a solo freelance motion designer who sits in front of a computer and opens After Effects and makes animation, why would they want to think about incorporating?
That's a great question. And again, the answer, it depends. It depends what your objectives are. It depends sort of what your big picture is going to be. There are tax benefits to it. There are employment benefits to it if you have employees. But I think the major reason that people tend to incorporate themselves in, you know, and when I say incorporate, that's a real generalized term because there are corporations, there are LLCs, there are partnerships, and there are sole proprietorships. Those are the four different, you know, types of business entities. So when you're saying not to incorporate, those are your options. A solo, you know, practitioner is going to be, you know, somebody who's not incorporated. But the other three entities, partnerships, LLCs, or corporations are your options when it comes to, you know, creating a business entity around your business. The key here is, I think the main reason that people tend to create a business entity around them is for liability purposes. The nice thing about incorporating, whether you're going to be a corporation or an LLC, is you get what's referred to as limited liability. The corporation becomes the liable party, not you individually. So let's just...
Can you define liability? Liability is a word that I'm sure you know what it means, but I think I know what it means, but let's just define it for everybody.
It means who is going to be responsible if there's a legal issue. So here's the situation. So you have you as the animator and you also have your company. If I wanted to sue you and I'm suing you based on something that you did on your own individual basis, I can come after you. I can come after your own personal assets. Okay. That is the real big issue. So if you don't have corporate protection or business entity protection, if you are sued and a judgment is against you, then people can come after your individual assets. So what incorporating does is it separates you from a business, and then it's only the business that is exposed to liability.
So okay? let me make sure I understand it. So if it's just Joey as the animator and Joey gets sued, let's say they come after me for damages and I don't have that much cash to give, they can repossess my car. They can go after my house, things like that. If I have a corporation that is separate from me, they can only go after assets that belong to the corporation?
That is correct. Absent, you know, other issues that might come into play.
Sure.
if it comes down to that, and we can have a discussion about that. But yeah, for the most part, the main issue is liability. If I am going to be sued, I want to make sure that my kid's college fund or that my house or that my car or that my own personal assets can't be subject to collection at a later date. That the only thing that could be is, you know, the judgment would attach to the business and then it's the business's responsibility to pay it.
So here's a question that I've always had, and I've gotten this question a lot and I'm not really sure how to answer it, but maybe you can help. You know, I could understand having a risk of being sued if you make tires, for example, and one of the tires you made is defective and it pops and someone's car gets totaled. But, you know, we're animators. We sit in front of a computer and we're clicking buttons and typing on the keyboard. And then at the end of it, we've created a video for someone that they put on TV or they put on YouTube or their website. There doesn't seem to be any obvious risk of being sued. So I'm wondering if you've got any thoughts on what the dangers are, you know, for motion designers.
Well, I think the big issues that motion designers are going to run into are obviously breach of contract issues. But again, if you're dealing with small, sums of money, $2,500 or something like that, that's, you know, even if it's a judgment against you personally, most people can probably manage. But now to sort of get my creative cap on, to think about the exposure that you might have. Here's the thing that you need to be careful of. You never know what somebody else is going to do. So let's use this example. I hire you to create a fancy 1 minute introduction for my YouTube channel. And you put it together and it's all awesome and you give it to me and now I have it. It's up on my YouTube channel. And now all of a sudden somebody comes to me and I get a cease and desist letter from a lawyer that says, oh, hey, by the way, you have copyrighted music in your video and it belongs to my client. And if you don't take it down, now I'm going to sue you.
Now,
copyright exposes you to huge amounts of damages if it is in fact copyrighted. And if, let's say, somebody comes after me for copyright infringement, who do you think I'm going to drag into that lawsuit?
Right.
I'm going to drag you in. Maybe you did it accidentally. Maybe you did it on purpose. Maybe you thought you had the rights to something, or better yet, maybe what you did was you purchased a license for that music for a different project and not for this project. And so it only applies to that last project. In other words, the license doesn't last in perpetuity. It's only for the specific purpose that you purchase it. But you thought it would be great for my video and you put it together. And now all of a sudden, guess what? I'm being sued for copyright infringement and I'm going to drag your ass in too, because that's on you. And now I'm going to be subject to damages because it's a 1 minute video. It's the music in there. It has, you know, 15,000 views and there is a huge amount of damages that's associated with that. I mean, it could be up to, you know, $3,500, if not more, per infringement.
Oof.
And if there's 15,000 views, do the math. That becomes a huge amount of damages on me. And if I'm going to drag you in there on that too, well, that becomes big money. And that might not be something you want against you personally, but you can say, hey, you're going to drag my company in because you and I, our relationship is not based on Andy and Joey. It's based on the Contagulia Law Firm and School of Motion. And as a result of that, because the nature of the business and the nature of the contract defines your company and my company, then I also know that they're not going to be able, you know, the people suing me for copyright infringement can't come after me individually. They can go after my company because it was my company that is using the materials and it is your company that produced them. So that is an example that I could see definitely coming up. And having done enough copyright litigation over the years, you know, I've seen really crazy things that have come up. I represented a blogger a few years ago, and there was, he pulled an image off of Google Images, thinking that, oh, it's on Google, it must be public domain. Well, that's not accurate, because the way Google pulls the information down, it spider crawls across the web. It just identifies all these different images, and it then just identifies that. And so he did a right-click save as, took the image, put it into his blog, and ended up getting sued by a company that purchased the copyright on those photographs that used to be, that was affiliated with the Denver Post. And so here he was in North Carolina being sued in federal court in Denver for an image that he pulled off of Google Images depicting the pat-down searches at Denver International Airport. And the company that was suing him was from Las Vegas. So, you know, he'd never been to Colorado, and here he was defending a lawsuit in federal court in Denver. He's just a blogger. You know, he's just talking about different things. He's taking images and commenting about them. And, you know, aside from all the fair use stuff that is possibly there, he had to defend this lawsuit. He was right at the end that everything was okay. But, you know, had he lost, a judgment would have been against him individually, because he just ran his blog as himself. And so that becomes the problem. So nowadays, when you're looking around, and I mean, there is a lot out there that is what I'll refer to as public domain. And I think that's not even a good way of defining it. It's material that people have put out there, that composers have put out there, or that artists have put out there, that they are willing to give you a limited license. I mean, I should do a video on this, but have you ever read the terms and conditions of the music for YouTube, or any of those, any of the free sites out there where you can grab music or grab images and things like that? It's really limited in terms of what you're allowed to use it for. And so, you know, if you're not familiar with what those terms are, and, you know, even some of the websites where you can purchase a song to use in a video, you're only allowed to use it once. You can't use it multiple times. You have to purchase a license over and over and over, even if it's a $1 license. I represented a yoga studio here and in town, and they put a bunch of really nice meditative type of music onto an iPod, put it up in their yoga studio, and during yoga class they were playing it, and they got a cease and desist letter from lawyers representing BMI, which is one of the big licensing companies for music, saying, hey, you are infringing on our copyright, and you better stop or pay us large amounts of money. Or, hey, by the way, you could just go get a license from BMI for $750 a year, and you can use all of our songs without issue. And it depends on the type of license you get. So there are some really goofy ways that somebody could get wrapped up into something without ever even knowing it. And that's why I think, just from a liability perspective, put something between you and the other person, and that something is your company. That becomes your shield.
I'm sitting here clenching and shivering. I mean, like, I'm sure people listening to this are terrified now, because all of the things you've described are things that probably everybody in the industry has done, not on purpose, but just by accident. There's a very kind of, right, it's like an open secret that when you're designing stuff and you're pitching things to clients, you're moving really fast, and you're grabbing stuff off Google Images and Flickr and whatever to just mock things up and photo bash things. And it's all, copyrighted stuff. And so basically it sounds like the liability part of putting up making a corporation is that if the worst happens, if you screwed up knowingly or unknowingly, and all of a sudden a judge says you owe $2.5 million, your company can go bankrupt, but you're still okay. You're still whole.
Great way of putting it. Okay. Absolutely.
Got it.
And it's you know, another thing, I'm sure there's somebody listening to this right now going about, but what about fair use, fair use, fair use? And I get the understanding. And just to really, there are some limitations to which you can use somebody else's copyrighted material in your own work. If you're providing commentary, if you're, you know, doing it transformative, those are just a few examples. I did a video on it. It's on my YouTube channel about fair use. But the point that people fail to recognize when it comes to fair use is if you're raising fair use, it means you've been sued, because fair use is a defense to copyright infringement. It's not a permission slip to copyright infringement. And you have an obligation to prove fair use. So if you're out there saying, yeah, but it's fair use, it's fair use, it's fair use, that's great. I hope you have the budget to defend that, because that's going to be the issue later on. There's an artist in New York, I forgot his name, but he makes a living out of taking other people's Instagram photos, manipulating them a little bit, blowing them up and putting them in art galleries and charging, you know, large amounts of money for people to come in and take a look at other people's photos that he has transformed. And he has been sued multiple times in various states over this. He has been successful to some extent. But most recently, and when I say most recently, I mean within the last year or so, he's been sued in New York. And the judge is like, listen, guys, you know, you don't get to just file a motion to dismiss and say that this is fair use, because fair use has a laundry list of terms, you know, a laundry list of items that a court needs to consider to determine whether it really is fair use. And if you don't meet those terms, guess what? Not fair use. But who do you have to go to? What do you have to go through? You have to defend that lawsuit in order to present your case that it is in fact fair use. So I hear people say, yeah, but this is fair use. And I'm like, great. Are you prepared to litigate that issue? Are you prepared to go to trial and fight this against Google, against, you know, the Denver Post, against any of these other people who might have a much bigger bank account than you? And if you are, great, go for it. If not, pull back. So the best thing to do, and you know, we started this conversation off with liability, right? We sort of now segued into copyright a little bit, but I think the best thing that people can do, and you'd be surprised how cooperative people can be. Call them up and ask them, hey, I came across your image. I love it. I'm a blogger. I'm an animator. I would love to be able to use your image in something that I produce. Would you give me permission to do that? What's the worst thing they're going to do? Say no. But many times people be flattered. Yeah, I would love to. Just give me credit for it. Great. Formalize it with an email. Formalize it with something that shows that you've been given permission for it, and then move forward and utilize it. Sometimes that 15 minutes of uncomfortableness can save you a lifetime of just anguish.
Such amazing advice. And I have to say too that, you know, nowadays it's so easy and inexpensive to get stock imagery, stock music. You know, I mean, stock music used to cost $300 to $500 per use, and now you go to Premium Beat, and you know it's like $40 or $50. You can get an Adobe Stock membership, you know, for $30-$40 a month, or a Shutterstock membership, and it's like, you know, it may seem expensive, right? But I guarantee it's a lot less expensive than getting sued.
It is, and I think, you know, but even under those circumstances, you know, make sure you read through the terms and conditions of what you're allowed to use it for. Some of these people have, you know, some of these licenses that are put out there, you know, you're not allowed to use it for commercial purposes, meaning you can't make money off of it. If you're doing it for fun and you want to add it to your video because, hey, this is my travel video, I'm going to share it with my friends and family, great. But if you're now putting it in a commercial and you're trying to drag and, you know, bring people to your website so you can earn money off of it, that becomes a commercial use. And sometimes in situations like that, the people who own the copyrights on that are going like, listen, I don't mind you using my stuff, but guess what? Pay me $5 for a license to go ahead and put it in your commercial, right? If you're going to generate income from it. You know, I put a lot of effort into that. I'm sure every one of your listeners will be pissed off as hell if somebody pilfered the things that they spent 3 weeks developing.
Okay. So this copyright conversation has made me really uncomfortable for some reason. I think it's really, it's kind of one of the scariest parts of what we do, because it's there's a lot of rules, there's a lot of unknowns, you know, it kind of feels like everyone's kind of cheating and just hoping they don't get caught. But hopefully from this conversation, at least, you know, everyone listening kind of understands that there are risks, however small they might be, that if you get caught, the consequences can be enormous, and incorporating can provide a buffer between you and the person suing you. So let's talk about corporations a little bit more. You know, there's, you mentioned that there's corporations, there's partnerships, there's sole proprietorships. Can you briefly just kind of describe what the differences are?
Okay. So just to sort of recap, the business entities that we have are corporations, partnerships, and those include general partnerships, limited liability partnerships, or limited liability limited partnerships. Those are all different forms of partnerships. I know. And limited liability and limited liability companies. So I'll tell you this. I have taught a course on business entities, and it's a 4-month course at 3 hours a day. I mean, the depth that this goes into is incredible. But let me see what I can do to simplify this as much as possible. So starting with the first one, corporations, really what people have defined as the the formal business entity. You have C corporations and you have S corporations, and real briefly, the difference between the two is the nature of how they are taxed. A C corporation gets what's referred to as a double taxation. An S corporation is taxed as a partnership, and you get what's referred to as flow through taxation. I'm going to go into a little bit more detail on that as well. Then you have partnerships. In these limited liability partnerships, similar situation. You have a flow-through taxation issue regarding that, but it's still a business relationship where the business is owned by the partners, whereas in a corporation, the business is owned by shareholders. And then you have limited liability companies where the business is owned by members. So the owners of each of these, they are given different names, but they are specific to that type of business entity. And it drives me crazy when people go, oh yeah, my partner. I'm like, what kind of business entity are you? Oh, we're an S corporation. All right, so they're not a partner. They're, a partner is part of a partnership. A member is a part of an LLC. A shareholder is part of a corporation. So that's how those are defined. And really what you do in each of these situations, whether you are a member, whether you are a partner, whether you are a shareholder, those designations define your ownership interest in that business entity. And you can own 100% of it. You can own 50%, 10%. And what you see people doing is selling portions of their company, or, you know, divvying out interests in their company. So-and-so is a 5% owner. So-and-so is a 10% owner. And that's really sort of how those are all broken down. But they all function very similarly. And what I mean by that is they provide you the appropriate protection. With the exception of a general partnership or a limited partnership, if you want the limited liability, which is what a limited liability company and a corporation give you, in other words, company is liable, not you individually, you need to be a limited liability partnership. So you have to have that designation of limited liability. Now, the interesting thing here is all of these business entities are created at the state level. And what I mean by that is you will incorporate, or you will, you'll create your business entity at the state level. You'll incorporate in Delaware, you'll incorporate in Florida, you'll incorporate in Colorado, whatever it is. But that is where the creation of your business entity begins, is at the state level, the state that you decide you actually want to incorporate in. Does that make sense?
That does make sense. And, I think everyone listening, I guarantee that no one listening is going to want to sit through. I'm sure it's very interesting, Andy, but the 4-month course, 3 hours a day that goes into the different business entities. But what they're wondering is, like, at the bottom of it is, which one's right for me? And and let's try to simplify it a little bit. Once you get multiple people involved, if you have multiple, business owners or shareholders, members, then it gets more complicated. But for a freelancer, just a one man band, right, or one woman band, it seems like an LLC or an S corporation would be the most useful you know, in corporations to start. So A, would you agree with that? And I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about the differences between those two.
Okay. So first of all, somebody operating on their own can't be a partnership. The reason for that is the definition of a partnership is two or more people. So as an individual, you cannot be a partnership. So let's just throw that one right out. So if we're just talking about a single person, your options really are then a sole proprietor, okay, a C corporation, an S corporation, or a single person LLC. Now, the interesting thing is here from a tax purpose, and I'm going to caveat this discussion on tax with, I'm not a tax lawyer. I know, you know, very generally about the tax laws. And, you know, when it comes to taxes, it's so very important to consult with a tax attorney or your accountant to really determine what is going to be the best, you know, business structure for you from a tax basis. All right. So make sure that you get the proper tax advice from a licensed tax professional before venturing into this. And I really have to sort of caveat all of this because the federal government really doesn't like that. And I don't think my malpractice carrier would either. But let's sort of get into this very generally. So when from tax purposes, if you're an LLC, you're going to be treated as what's referred to as a disregarded entity. Because for tax purposes, a business entity from a tax standpoint is either disregarded, meaning an LLC. So an LLC is not classified by the Internal Revenue Service. But what is are C corporations, S corporations, and partnerships. When you apply for your business designation, that's at the state law level. So how the state classifies you as a business entity does not necessarily mean that you're going to get the same tax classification from as a business entity. And as I said, a state limited liability company or an LLC has an option at the tax level, whether it wants to be taxed as an S corporation or as a disregarded entity. You know, the tax classification is important because, you know, the different types of entities are very different. So when it comes to those, a disregarded entity like an LLC will be treated like a sole proprietorship. In other words, the owner owns the assets and is subject to the liabilities and reports the income and expenses on his or her own personal income tax return.
Right.
So that's how that follows through. When it comes to a C corporation, a C corporation is defined as something that is not an S corporation. So if it's not an S corporation, it's a C corporation and is subject to two levels of taxation on its income. One at the entity level, in other words, the business, the corporation gets taxed based on the income the corporation receives. All right. And then another at the stockholder level when it's distributed. So if you're a C corporation and you own 100%, and let's just say your company, you know, has $100,000 profit, the company gets taxed on that $100,000 profit. If then you also receive $100,000 salary, you then get taxed individually on that $100,000 salary that you received.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, as it gets to, so that's commonly referred to as what's referred to as double taxation. The company gets taxed and then the individual shareholders gets taxed on the money that they've actually received.
Right.
When it comes through to an S corporation, and this is similar to a partnership, both of these are pass-through entities for the purposes of taxes, meaning it doesn't pay tax at the entity level. Instead, the profits and the losses pass through to the stockholders who then include those items on his or her own individual tax returns. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I'm going to do the thing where I try to explain it the way I see it in my head. You can correct me if this is wrong. Okay. So I'll translate it into motion designer speak. So, you know, if you don't have a corporation, and you're operating as a sole proprietorship where it's just you and maybe you register your name as a business name or something like that with City Hall. If you make $100,000 that year, then on your tax return, you will declare that you made $100,000 and you can get some deductions and things like that. And then you'll pay taxes on that. If you form an LLC, a essentially it's the same thing. The when you send an invoice, you'll send an invoice from your company. You won't send, you know, Joey Kornman doesn't send the invoice. School of Motion sends the invoice. Mm-hmm. But any money that School of Motion earns, it passes through directly to Joey. So there's no, like, School of Motion doesn't pay taxes. Joey still pays the taxes. Am I on the right track so far?
Correct. And really what happens here in that situation is Joey's going to pay taxes on the, you know, whatever the profit is that the company makes, even if Joey doesn't receive it. That's really the key. So let's just say School of Motion as an LLC makes, you know, $100,000 profit and keeps $100,000 in the bank, or let's just say $50,000 in the bank, and sends a check to Joey for $50K. Joey's going to pay taxes on $100,000, not the $50.
Right.
So you're paying your taxes based on the full amount that the company makes, and not the what has been distributed to you. So that's sort of the downside to, you know, these flow through tax entities, because, you know, the individual owner is going to be taxed on the entire sum that the company makes in proportion to what they own. So if you have a partner, you'll each pay, you know, your portion of that.
So I want to bring up something that you just mentioned, because this was something I did not understand at all the first time I incorporated. I didn't understand that, you know, so one common thing to do is you set up a corporation, School of Motion, and School of Motion earns income, and then School of Motion pays Joey a salary. And so, you know, initially I thought, oh, well, that's great, because if School of Motion makes a lot of money, but I don't feel like, you know, paying all these taxes on it, I'll just leave it in the company and just pay myself a smaller salary. And then maybe the next year I'll pay myself a bigger salary. And it doesn't work that way. Whatever the company makes, if it's an LLC or if it's a single owner S corporation, it passes right through to the owner and you're paying taxes on it.
That's absolutely correct. And the same thing with an S corporation as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it typically what tax people are going to tell you to do is, listen, expect to pay taxes on all the money that you're going to receive. Sometimes the best things to do is, you know, give bonuses to your employees, you know, spend the money if you don't want to pay taxes on it, or give it to you, or take a bonus yourself. But, you know, the goal here is you want to be able to, you don't want to pay taxes on money that you didn't actually receive. And that's kind of the problem that you end up running into with some of these flow through entities, is that you may end up paying, you know, taxes on a full amount of income. You better make sure that you've withheld enough from an individual basis.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a good point to just once again reiterate that you should definitely have an accountant if you incorporate. And, you know, even if it's an LLC, which in from a tax perspective is fairly simple, everything flows through to you, the owner, there are still tax implications in terms of how things have to get filed and things like that. And this might be a good place to talk about the advantage of not doing an LLC from a tax perspective and doing a corporation. You mentioned there's two types of corporations, S corporations and C corporations. I would just probably make a blanket statement: no individual should have a C corporation. It seems typically like publicly traded companies with lots of shareholders, those are the types of companies that do a C corp. Is there any other reason that, you know, a freelancer should do a C corp?
Well, it really depends. I mean, if you're looking to start a big business and raise a lot of money, I mean, there are limitations on what an S corporation can do. So like an S corporation, you're only allowed to have one class of stock. You're only allowed to have, you can't have more than 100 stockholders. Within certain exceptions, you know, the stockholders have to be citizens or residents of the United States. And, you know, for the most part, it's a much more common entity than C corporations. But the problem that you may run into is, if you're going to change, if you're going to be a corporation and then change later on, you could run into problems from a tax basis. In other words, if you're a C corporation, when you incorporate, and then you decide that you want to make an S corporation election after the formation, and you don't do it within the proper time frame, there could be adverse tax consequences to that too. In other words, you may end up paying taxes on money that, or I'm sorry, on assets that appreciated in value during the time that you were a C corporation.
Okay.
So that becomes a really big issue. So, you know, what I tell people is, listen, always get, you know, get an accountant on board and talk to your accountant or your tax advisor, whether it's a lawyer or an accountant, to really decide what is the best entity structure for you from a tax purpose. I can talk to you about business entities from a liability standpoint, when it comes to lawsuits and things like that. But when it comes to tax purposes, I think really, you know, getting your CPA or your tax lawyer on board is really the important thing to do. But, you know, these little nuances can really make a difference in terms of maximizing, you know, the gain that you have from a business standpoint.
Absolutely. And I, you know, I asked in preparation for chatting with you today, I actually asked my CPA a bunch of questions because I have, you know, I understand just enough of how all this works. So I'm going to attempt to explain it. And you can kind of correct me if I screw anything up. But from my understanding, from a tax perspective, an LLC is basically the same as no LLC, right? If you just go out and you make money, or you set up an LLC and make money through that, from a tax perspective, there's no difference. Now, if you make an S corporation, there is a difference, and I'm going to attempt to explain what it is here. So there's this really crappy thing in the United States called the self-employment tax. So mm-hmm. if you go out and you get hired by somebody, you just get a job, then what happens is your income is taxed, and there's a couple of taxes that you pay, Social Security and Medicare, which for some reason, some historical reason, your employer splits that with you. So you pay half of that tax, comes out of your paycheck, but the other half the company pays for. Now, when you go freelance, all of a sudden you're required to pay all of that, and that's called the self-employment tax, and it ends up, it depends how much you make, but I think it can end up being like 15% or something like that. How am I doing so far, Andy?
You're doing great. And I think that's really an important aspect of it. When, you know, with the business entity protection, you know, one of the things that you do is you get to sort of split the, you know, the cost of that self-employment tax, you know, among many other people. So
yeah, exactly. So, but as a freelancer, if you have an LLC, you're getting that full self-employment tax because everything that you're Correct. Paying, everything that you're earning is being taxed as income. So when you get a paycheck from your boss, that's income. If a client writes you a check as a freelancer, that's also income. So now here's the cool thing about an S corporation. An S corporation allows you to be a shareholder in your own company. So as a freelancer, you could call yourself Animation, you know, Incorporated, and you are the sole shareholder of Animation Incorporated. You own 100% of all of the shares. And it's kind of a weird concept, okay? But now Animation Incorporated earns $100,000 that year, okay? You can pass all of that, you know, through to you as income. So you earned 100 grand that year, and you'll pay the full self-employment tax on that entire 100 grand. But there's another option. Because you are a shareholder of that corporation, you're actually allowed to take what are called distributions. So it's kind of like if you buy Coca-Cola stock or, you know, McDonald's, like one of these blue chip stocks, a few times a year, you'll get a check from them. You'll get a distribution from them based on profits. So you're able to do that as a shareholder in your own company. And that is not taxed as income. It's taxed differently. And so you don't have to pay the self-employment tax on that income. How am I doing?
You're doing good. And I think the important aspect of this here is when you receive a distribution that is typically taxed. It's taxed at a different level than the ordinary income. So when you receive money as a sole proprietor, that gets taxed at the ordinary income rate, which is a higher tax rate than a distribution, which typically, if, from what I understand, is taxed at a capital gains rate, which is a lower tax rate. So you see people who want to give themselves distributions and things like that. But you know, that's a little bit different as an S corp. If you're an LLC, you're not going to get that type of advantage. If you're a partnership, you're not going to get that type of advantage.
Right. And so when we set up, and so, you know, School of Motion is set up as an S corporation for that reason. And the way that my CPA explained it to me is this: if you pay yourself, let's say that there's $100,000 to play with, right? If you pay that to yourself as income, then it's taxed as income. You're going to pay the 15% self-employment tax. But if you pay yourself a salary of $50,000 and then you take $50,000 in distributions, then on the $50,000 that was your salary, you pay the self-employment tax. But on the other $50,000, you pay less taxes. So you're essentially keeping more of the money that your company's earning by being an S corporation. And there's lots of rules about this. You know, the obvious question is, well, why can't I just pay myself all of my salary through distributions? Well, the IRS doesn't like that and they'll come after you and you need an accountant to counsel you.
I think there's a limitation in terms of your income, in terms of the amount that you are allowed to take as distribution income and what you have to pay your ordinary income and your personal taxes on. So, you know, in that respect, you know, tax planning is all very important, and there are ways that you can, you know, minimize your tax liability. But that's beyond my knowledge, and you know, talk to your accountant when you go through your tax returns. All of those things are taken into consideration.
Yeah, 100%. You have to talk to an accountant, you know, that knows what they're doing to do all of these things. And so in the end, you know, when freelancers ask me, should I incorporate? And, you know, it sounds like at this point from our conversation, I would just say yes. It just simply from the liability standpoint, it's smart to do. And it's, you know, it's getting really inexpensive and easy to do. But S corporations are a little more complex in terms of the requirements to maintain them, and you have to have officers and minutes and things like that. So they are a little more expensive to set up and run. And so there's basically a math problem that your accountant can help you with. And that math problem goes something like this: if the tax savings that I'm gonna get from having the S corp is greater than the cost of operating the S corp, you do the S corp.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you do an LLC.
I think right, and if you don't want to put the efforts in to managing a corporation the proper way, don't do it. Do an LLC. I mean, the nice thing about LLCs are it's a real simple business entity. It was created for its simplicity. You know, the formalities aren't there. You don't have to have minutes. You don't have to have annual meetings. You don't have the corporate formalities that you do with an S corporation or a C corporation. And you still get the limited liability. So from, you know, a liability standpoint, you know, you're protecting yourself, you know, from, you know, individual liability by using that business entity. And that becomes, you know, really beneficial to you. Corporation wise, you need to maintain the formalities of that. You need to make sure that you keep your minutes. And from a legal standpoint, from a litigation standpoint, I got to throw this in there, is because corporations are viewed as a more formal business entity or business structure than an LLC or a partnership, courts have a tendency to give it more credibility. And I bring that up because in the litigation that I have seen recently with issues of what's referred to as piercing the corporate veil, and that is when somebody is sued and the person suing them is able to go past the business entity and go against the individual's personal assets to collect or hold them individually accountable. The cases that I've seen that happen in most have been where the business entity pierced was an LLC. And part of the reason for that is because because the formalities are so limited, people have a tendency to be, I don't know, more free-spirited with the entity and not take things seriously and go out and buy personal groceries on their, you know, on their business credit card and you know, commingle things like that. And because, you know, it's a little more lackadaisical. And as a result of that, you see people making mistakes in the operation of their business. They think, oh, I'm an LLC and therefore I'm automatically protected. But what they don't realize is they're still, you know, they have one credit card for the company and they're using it for their own personal stuff, or they have their own personal credit card and they're using it all for business stuff. And you see the sort of commingling of things, and the business entity just becomes an alter ego. It's just a spinoff of you personally. And then you see those people get, you know, hit individually. So, you know, if you're going to be an LLC, you still have to manage it properly. And what I mean by that is make sure you have your operating agreement. Make sure you have separate bank accounts. Make sure that even though it's not required, meet with the other members once a year and put things in writing and make it formal and do all the things that you would normally do for a corporation with your LLC as well. Because that, you know, the level of formality that you give it will actually end up protecting you in the long run.
I want to reiterate what you just said, because it's super important, that there's this concept of piercing the corporate veil, which it sounds like this really cool kind of ninja-like thing. And from my understanding, it basically means if you have a corporation and you feel protected, oh, if I get sued, the corporation can go out of business, but they can't touch my house, they can't touch my car. That only works if you follow the rules. And the rules are essentially they have to be totally separate entities. You can't take your company credit card and buy yourself a new home theater and call it a business expense. If you get caught, they're going to say, well, you and the business really aren't separate. So we are going after your personal assets.
Absolutely right. And what I see is here's how people justify. Well, yeah, I went out and I bought the home theater with my business credit card, but the company owed me $5,000. And I'm like, great. Then guess what? Cut yourself a check.
Right. Yeah.
Cut yourself a check from your business, deposit it into your own personal account, and then go buy your home theater with your personal money. So you've earned your income. Now what you do with your income after that is entirely up to you. But unless that home theater is somehow related to your business, you're going to have problems.
Exactly. And we talked briefly about the filing requirements of these two entities. With an LLC, it's not very much. You pay a lawyer to set it up, or you go on, you know, LegalZoom.com or something like that. And then I think once a year, there's basically a fee that you pay. For an S corporation, there's a lot more than that. And I'm wondering, Andy, if you could just kind of briefly describe what those requirements are. And I'm assuming that that's something you help your clients with. And how much does that cost if you're helping a business meet? All that.
Absolutely. So for the most point, I tell people, listen, you can incorporate on your own. It's really pretty easy to do. And so, the creation of a business entity, as I mentioned earlier, starts at the state level. So every state has what's referred to as a Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State's office is the state organization that, you know, hands out the designations for various businesses to create, you know, your business entity. So if you look on your local Secretary of State website, you will see a plethora of information about the various business entities that are available in your state. And you can typically log in, you can create a new business entity, fill out the form, pay the filing fee, and boom, all of a sudden, there you are. You are now a corporation, or you are now an LLC. What you do from that point then is go to like the IRS website, take your certificate of good standing, put in that you're a new corporation or a new LLC, you know, file for a tax identification number. You can do that online as well through the irs.gov. And then bang, you've got yourself a tax ID number for your new business. So now you've got your certificate of good standing. Now you've got your tax ID number. You run off to the bank and you open up your business account. Here you go. Here's my certificate of standing. Here's my tax ID number. Now I need some checks. I need a credit card, and you're off and running. You're an operating company at that point. It is pretty simple to do. Now, when it comes to, if you have multiple owners of these companies, the best thing to do is have, you know, for an LLC, you're going to need an operating agreement at a minimum. Even if you are an individual, you're an individual who owns your LLC, I think it's a good thing to have. Many banks will require you to have a completed operating agreement just to show that you're taking it seriously and you're not just running off and opening up business entities, but that you're taking the time to create and organize it. The operating agreement is the contract that governs the management of the LLC when it comes to, and the ownership of the LLC, the splitting of the interests. So that can all be done in one document. When it comes to corporations, typically what you'll do is you'll have your articles of incorporation. You will have a shareholder agreement that defines the ownership relationship of the shareholders and what the ownership interest is, whether you own 100%, whether it's split 50-50, what you can and cannot do with the shares of stock that you have. And that goes into a pretty big conversation, down the line. But then you also have bylaws. Bylaws are the management of the company or of the corporation. And what I tell people is, listen, in a business, you're going to wear one, if not all, of these three hats. So the first hat that you might have is ownership. You can be an owner of a business. Okay, so that's hat number one. Hat number two is management. Hat number three is employment. So you can be an owner of a company, but never be in part of managing. So you may not sit on the board of directors, but you may end up owning it. Think of that like you own shares of stock in Adobe. I don't know if they're public or not, but if you own shares of stock in a public company, there you are. You're a shareholder in that company, but you don't sit on the board of directors, and you're not an employee. But you might also be a manager. Look at many of the companies out there that just hire people to be on their board of directors to help manage the company that don't have an ownership interest in it. And you can do that. And I've seen small companies say, I really like this guy's ideas. He's going to come in. He's going to sit on the board of directors. And this individual is going to help me manage my company. And he will not own it. Then you have employees. Maybe you want to hire somebody who's going to be the business director. And so you say, hey, can you come and help me out, be my business director, and you'll be an employee. Now, in a small business or as an entrepreneur, we might wear all three of those hats. We might be the owner, we might be a manager, and we might be an employee. So those are the three classifications of a business entity, really, is what it comes down to.
So one last thing I want to talk about, and you brought it up right at the beginning of this conversation about corporations, is that one of the other advantages you can get from having a corporation comes if you start to hire people. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how having a corporation could help you if, for example, you start as a freelancer and you start an S corporation for the tax benefits and you're operating on your own, but then after a few years, you start getting more and more work. And after a while, you say, you know what, I could kind of justify bringing on, a junior animator to help me with all this work. What does having the corporation, help you with in terms of having employees?
I think the important thing here is obviously for liability purposes, if you end up with employee disputes, you want them obligated to the company and not to you individually. So I think from a liability standpoint, that's really important. But the reality is, do you need a corporation to have employees? No. Would I advise it? Absolutely. I think you should. So again, it's no different because you're entering into relationships with these people. You're entering into a legal relationship with them. They are employees. And so now you have employment laws that need to be, accounted for, primary one being you can't force somebody to work more than 40 hours a week unless you pay them overtime after 40 hours. They can't work more than a certain number of 12-hour shifts in a row. And again, I don't know the whole details on the employment aspect of things. But, the laws that are in place for employees are much different than the individual if they're just an independent contractor. And the more you start to control somebody's time with you, the more they're going to be an employee of your company rather than an independent contractor. That's another conversation that we can certainly have. But from an employment standpoint, I think the last thing you ever want to do is if there's going to be an employment dispute, you would rather have that disgruntled employee fighting with the company than with you individually. And in some circumstances, you can, you know, you can buy insurance to protect yourself from, you know, employment-related disputes. You can have HR companies represent you, and they may put requirements in place that you be a business entity as well. So again, this is about liability. This is about separating you from everybody else and protecting you, Joey, not School of Motion. I mean, you'll protect School of Motion, but the important thing here is keeping you as separate from the company as possible.
You know, this is such a rabbit hole. I mean, you know, I think everyone listening was kind of maybe hoping that there was just some simple tips, five easy tips to not get sued. And the reality of it is it's just so much more complex, and there's so many ins and outs. So let's leave it with this. You've been super generous with your time. So I have one more question. Someone listening, and they've heard, you know, this entire conversation from contracts to incorporating, and with a little bit of copyright law thrown in there. And let's say that they're about to go freelance and they want to do it the right way, but, you know, they're overwhelmed. What's a good starting point? Should they just get on LegalZoom.com and pay a couple hundred bucks to do this? Or should they go find a lawyer and start a relationship and do it that way?
Again, the answer, it depends.
Oh, come
on. It's going to depend on your budget. Now, I will say this. I am not a fan of legal forms. But I will say that they do provide a purpose. And one of the purposes is, you know, they're inexpensive. And you can go to companies like LegalZoom and, you know, or just ask a lawyer and buy a template. But unless you have the sophistication of understanding what the contract means, just because you go and buy an operating agreement from LegalZoom, or you go buy, a services agreement, a generic services agreement from LegalZoom or from somebody else, do you really understand what it means? Do you understand when it goes through and it says, you know, insert governing law here, and you're like, well, what do you mean? What does that mean? Insert venue clause here. What does that mean? If you're sophisticated enough to understand and interpret what those contracts mean, then by all means, go ahead. Or educate yourself. You know, listen to podcasts like this. Watch videos that are on my YouTube channel to learn about, you know, the different areas of law so you can protect yourself. So get educated about what you're going to do. Don't just go out there and purchase these things with the hopes that it's going to fit. Because, you know, just because you go grab a hammer out of the toolbox, it doesn't mean you're going to, you know, get the screw in properly. Can you get a screw in the wall with a hammer? Absolutely. But is it the right tool for the job? No, it's not. So making sure that you have the proper understanding of how things operate, and making sure that you understand that you have the right contract for the right deal, that's it. And then most importantly, if you're going to go into these forms, still take the time to build the relationship with your client. Really sit down and help understand what the needs of the client are. Because what I find is the lack of communication between the parties is really the cornerstone as to the problems that they end up having later on. If everybody's on the same page and everybody trusts one another and everybody is willing to work with one another, it makes the deal-making portion of this so much easier. And that is all part of the preventative law. That is all part of my pitch to make sure that you understand what you're doing and take the precautions now so you don't run into problems later.
And that's it for Mr. Andy Contagulia. Head over to contagulia.com/School of Motion. That's Contagulia, contagulia.com/School of Motion, where Andy has left a little gift there for our listeners. And he also has a bunch of free videos that can teach some basic legal ideas and help you get your head wrapped around some of these very grown-up concepts. Now, I know this stuff is not the sexiest information to go through, but if you plan on being a professional in this field, you kind of have to bite the bullet and deal with legal issues. Thanks, as always, for listening. Check out schoolofmotion.com for show notes and information about all the amazing classes we offer, and I will catch you next time.